This is Alpha Geek Radio.
The following is a production of Galactic Netcasts.
Attention, Galactic Collective. The Sci-Fi Geeks Club is next. Please stand by.
You can take part in the podcasts by providing feedback. Send a message to galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. Call the voicemail number at 805-328-3966 or leave an audio message directly on our website, galacticnetcasts.com. We also invite you to join the Galactic Collective. All the information and links can be found at gncasts.com/galacticcollective. That's gncasts.com/galacticcollective. Now, without further ado, hear ye, hear ye! Another meeting of the Sci-Fi Geeks Club is officially called to order!
Thank you, Daryl. Hello, and welcome to another production of Galactic Netcasts, the Sci-Fi Geeks Club. I'm Dave Nelson. Joining me tonight on the panel is... I totally didn't, like, change the document for this, so I have to use my memory. Brad Ludwig is here. Hi, Brad.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing all right.
You have not been on the show for a couple episodes. You were out sick for a while.
I was.
How you feeling?
I'm feeling better. A little nasally yet, and just a tiny bit of a cough. But other than that, I'm doing all right.
Also on the panel is the co-host of the podcast on our show. I'm having a weird brain fart right now. Co-host of Podcast of Terror with Matt Stein on the Galactic Netcast Network. Welcome, Corey Scott. Hi, Corey.
That is the five-star reviewed Podcast of Terror.
That's right. You put up on Facebook earlier today a rave review of Podcast of Terror, right?
I was as surprised as anybody that... yes, we have gotten, I think, possibly a first review on iTunes, and it was incredibly nice and encouraging.
Nice.
So if anybody wants to do that for this podcast, we would appreciate it as well. just search for us on iTunes and give us those 5 stars and a positive review. That would be great. Thank you very much. Well, welcome, Corey and Brad. Our guest this week is the host of the Jukebox Podcast, an indie music podcast. He works as a journalist and musician in the city of Chicago as well. From Chicago, Illinois, welcome to the Sci-Fi Geeks Club, Mr. Brett Stewart. Brett, how are you?
Hello there. I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It is a complete honor, and I have been quite a fan of the show for a little while now, so I'm stoked to be here.
Oh, stop it. No, continue. Continue if you want to.
I'm very, very excited to be here.
Thanks, man. So tell us a little bit about the Jukebox Podcast. Sounds interesting.
Yeah, the Jukebox Podcast is really a labor of love between myself and a couple other people that work on it. We wanted to create a podcast that highlights independent musicians and curates an experience for people to discover them. And beyond that, create a community in which people can interact with them and find new music and all of that fun stuff. So the Jukebox started off as a monthly publication, and what we did is we put it out every month, and it had anywhere between 10 and 30 independent musicians, and I'll have them on the show, we'll talk about them, we'll play their music, we'll do interviews, and of late, we've been doing special reports where we go out and we do even more interviews. We've been talking with, for example, in the last 2 weeks, we did special reports with the touring pianist who toured with John Denver in the last decade of his life. We worked with the man who produced Regina Spektor and the Strokes in the early 2000s, and all these fun interviews and stuff, in addition to these curated shows that come out on a monthly basis. So it's an all-encompassing portal that we want to create to benefit independent musicians and get them heard, because we get inundated every month with thousands of independent musicians, and it's very, very hard to sort through that because there's a lot of crap. There is a lot of crap in the independent music scene, but there are a lot of exceptionally talented people as well that deserve more credit and more of a spotlight on them. So that's exactly what the Jukebox endeavors to do.
Where can people find it, by the way?
You can find it at jukeboxpodcast.com. And over there, you can actually find a bunch of cool things. We do monthly playlists now where our listeners, we propose a question at the beginning of every month, and then they write in, and then we make a Spotify and a YouTube playlist with all those songs. And it's a fun way to kind of curate the experience even more and have these fun playlists you can go into every month that have a theme to them. So last month, we did, you know, what's your favorite workout song? And then the month before that, we did what is a song that got you through a hard time? And we got some of the most intimate, heartbreaking, wonderful emails I've ever read in my life from people who music just touched them in a really profound way. So we're doing a bunch of fun stuff over there. If you're a music fan, there's music of everything over there, whether it's rap, hip-hop, R&B, blues, folk, everything, we play it.
You know, I think that you are our very first music podcast host, right, Brad? Don't you think?
No, we had...
We had Hammond Chamberlain, right? He was...
Yeah.
His
yeah.
podcast deals with a little music, right?
Well, yeah. It as I recall, it tilts a little bit more towards more music, but it's not... I don't think it's a dedicated entirely to music.
Who else have we had music for music podcasts?
I know that we've had Marion Call.
Oh, yeah. Podcast host.
Amazing musician.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, Brett, thank you very much for coming on again. And you have an exceptional voice. You've got the best voice on this particular episode of the Sci-Fi Geeks Club.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. I like your guys' voices too. So thanks for having me.
Thanks, man. All right. So this is the podcast where we do talk about everything sci-fi related. And before we start talking about the latest news, got to remind everybody about the Galactic Collective. If you would like to be part of an exclusive club, an exclusive inner circle of listeners, here's what you do. Go to our website, gncasts.com, and click on the little thing that says Join the Galactic Collective, all right? That will take you to the information page, which explains everything. But basically, it's a way for you to support our network with as little as $1 a month. That will go towards things like web hosting, let's see, audio hosting, and hopefully some advertising soon as well. So we encourage you to do that. $1 a month is like, that's less than one cup of coffee at like Starbucks, right? Or even a cheaper coffee place than Starbucks.
Yeah, you can get 7 cups of coffee.
Yeah. So $1 a month will go to us. We're not going to do crazy things with it. We're going to pay for things like hosting and advertising and you know, stuff that keeps the lights on here at the Galactic Netcast Network. So again, go to gncasts.com and click on the Join the Galactic Collective. And there's some perks, you know, for being part of it. Like, we're going to start doing the quarterly, would it be quarterly, Brad? Like, just one, you know, maybe 3 or 4 times a year. I guess if it was 4 times a year, it'd be quarterly, right?
It would be quarterly, huh?
Quarterly hangout with listeners, where you get to hang out with us in a Google Hangout, and we get to talk the past, the present, the future of Galactic Netcasts, what you have to ask us, any suggestions that you have for the network. You know, you can become an influence in what we do, the kind of content that we pump out with Galactic Netcast by becoming a member of the Galactic Collective. So again, gncasts.com and join today. All right, let's dive into the sci-fi news of the week. And this is probably my favorite story of the 4 that I picked this week. Neil deGrasse Tyson says the Enterprise would destroy the Millennium Falcon. It's the long debated topic, much like the whole Captain Kirk versus Captain Picard. In this case, it's Star Wars versus Star Trek, which is better. In a recent video interview with National Geographic, the astrophysicist and TV host finally set the record straight when asked whether he'd choose Han Solo's ship or the famous Star Trek vessel. Tyson chose the Federation starship. There's no question, he exclaimed, explaining how the Enterprise has the benefit of being based in some semblance of reality, and it was groundbreaking for its being the first spaceship in science fiction designed expressly for exploration. And this came from The Verge, and they added, that, of course, if you're wondering which would be or which would win in a space battle, it's not exactly the fairest fight. The original Enterprise was a Constitution-class starship. A junky freighter like the Falcon is comparatively puny and wouldn't have the firepower to best the Federation flagship at full power. The Falcon would probably have an easier time besting the Enterprise in terms of raw speed and probably maneuverability as well, don't you guys think?
Yes,
absolutely.
And I think when you're looking at the metric that they're looking at this as, they're looking at raw speed and then power, where I think there's another thing you have to take into account, and that is the maneuverability that the Falcon has, I think would, in a way, outsmart some ways the Enterprise. Like, immediately when I read the story, what came to my mind was a scene in Empire when Han is escaping via the asteroid belt.
Yeah.
So I feel like, yep. And in that case, I would imagine the Imperial Star Destroyer is equally as powerful as the Enterprise.
Yeah, not
so
as
that too.
Yeah, not as big, but probably just as powerful, if not more powerful than the Enterprise. And you have to call. you also have to take into consideration all the mechanical problems that the Millennium Falcon has, because it seems like there's always something going on or going wrong with it, right?
Yes,
very true.
Yeah, but it's not like the Enterprise didn't have things going wrong with it all the time. That's why we had Scotty, or why we had
Geordi.
Yeah, there was constantly something going wrong with those things too.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to see. I know there was a chart recently of all the famous science fiction spaceships and space vessels. I'd like to see the size difference between the Millennium Falcon and the Constitution class starship. And I'm thinking it's about the same as if you were to compare the Defiant from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, right? That's about probably the same size as the Millennium Falcon, I'm guessing.
Probably, or maybe the Firefly would be maybe in that kind of size range. But maybe what you have to take into account as well is, are we just comparing the ships, or are we comparing the crews or manning the ships? Because in that case, the Millennium Falcon gains ground, I think, with Han Solo's wit.
Yeah, that's true. But really, is it really Han, or is it Chewbacca that's the real master of that ship?
All I know is that Solo ain't following no prime directive, unless it's the remade version by Lucas of today, who thinks that Solo is the nice guy of the universe.
Well, we're going to find out the history of Han Solo, right? In one of those anthology movies. I guess they just recently, this is a story that came up that I didn't include in the prep this week, but there was a story about how they were casting the young Han Solo, and they had a lot of people show up. So there
4,500. Yeah.
How many?
4,500 showed up.
Holy crap. Cast and directors for that movie have their work cut out for them, that's for sure. But my original point was, we'll get to see what their take on Han Solo is with that movie, for sure.
Yep.
There's something was put up by Steven Spielberg where he was saying that there's no plans to recast Indiana Jones, even though that's been rumored for a while. It's hard to take such an iconic role from someone who's been in the role the entire time, and it's built it into being legendary status with Harrison Ford, and then say, okay, now we're going to take this other person and try to make them that character as well. It's really tough to do, and I almost don't want them to do a history of Han Solo because of that. It just doesn't seem necessary. There's such a wide universe to explore with Star Wars. Do we really need to go into the background of Han Solo without it being who we all perceive to be, and have only perceived to be, Han Solo?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's not our money to spend. It's their money.
Well, it is, in the sense of it takes someone buying tickets.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't.
Movies keep happening.
I don't think they'll have a problem financing that film, Corey.
I don't know. I don't think Star Wars is going to find any kind of success. It just seems too off the wall.
It's just a little indie film. You know, nobody knows about it.
No. Indie is the other film. Pay attention.
All right. So before we move on, are you guys? Do any of you already have your tickets for Episode 7 yet?
Yes.
Really?
I do.
Okay.
I have it for not for I bought them the night when they put out the trailer during the football game, and they put all the trailer, and then Fandango crashed. But I bought them for the 18th, so I won't be seeing it the 17th at midnight like a lot of people will, but I'll be seeing it in the evening in the 18th.
I got a feeling that, see, I haven't bought tickets yet, and I got a feeling that I'm going to be SOL. We're going to be scrambling at the very end.
Yeah, well, the pre-sale sold, what was the number? It was some. The pre-sale sold more than some films make in their opening weekend. Yeah. It's insane.
I know. I think it's definitely going to set some kind of record. That's for sure. Corey and,
I think it already has.
Corey and Brad, are you guys have your tickets yet or no?
No.
Mm-mm. Okay.
I don't like to go on opening weekends for films normally. I like to go to matinees, although I do have the option of going down to Marin to where they usually have a lot of the screenings for the big movies that Lucas likes to show.
And that's
where he might actually show up the theater.
Yeah, I was going to say that's his neck of the woods, right?
Yeah.
Didn't Tom Merritt end up in that theater, like in a theater with George Lucas?
I believe I remember that story. Yeah, him and Eileen.
Yeah. Wow, to live his life, man. Seriously.
Are you at all worried about the story being spoiled if you wait for a week to see a matinee?
Like anything? Of course I am. But I'm already trying to avoid watching... Well, I tried to avoid watching the trailers and the extended trailers and everything else that's been popping up. I don't want to get too overwhelmed by these things because these are films that I'm actually excited about, and it's rare that I get that many things at once coming out.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I don't think it's going to really ruin the experience for me. It's Star Wars, and it looks like a great movie. So at most, I'll be interested to see how people react more than I will be about every single detail about what happens. But I don't think this is going to be one of those situations where people aren't going to love this.
Yeah.
I just have a lot of faith in it right now.
All right, let's move on from Star Wars to Star Trek, and actually both J.J. Abrams joints. Speaking to Variety, Damon Lindelof admits keeping Khan's identity as a secret in Star Trek Into Darkness was a bad idea. He was talking to, like I said, to Variety about his current show, the HBO series The Leftovers, which is awesome. I haven't seen second season yet, though. Damon Lindelof, who helped write the Star Trek sequel script, said that the team's steadfast refusal to acknowledge that Cumberbatch was playing the iconic villain Khan, they instead billed him as John Harrison. He thinks that that fell flat. Yeah, kind of did. Mainly because, A, everyone guessed that Cumberbatch was Khan from pretty much the moment he was cast in the film. B, it was obvious from the moment Into Darkness started rehashing the plot of Wrath of Khan, who he was. And C, because the movie itself didn't treat the Khan reveal as a huge moment that could be ruined by a spoiler if acknowledged and swiftly moved on.
Frankly, if you will excuse it, there was no context. You reveal this character. Yeah, I know. I deserve that. You reveal this character, but there was nothing to be revealed. Nobody had any kind of background history to the character. It was only for previous fans of the original movies. So retelling what was a great movie, a great story, in such a way didn't benefit those fans, and the people who didn't know who the character was didn't care.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. I didn't think about that. Huh. You know, this is why I invite you. I keep inviting you back to the show, Corey. You bring new insight, things that we had never thought of.
And because I'm old and bitter.
Yay! Welcome to the club.
J.J. Abrams, by the way, also recently admitted that the film leaned a little too hard on its homage to Wrath of Khan. Do you think people would have thought better of the film, or would have thought the film was better if they would have promoted the fact that that Cumberbatch was playing Khan, or didn't hide the fact?
Yes, and I think it's for the reason, because then you would have established who Khan was. This is a movie that's dealing with the new version of Khan, and you could have done stuff with that character. Trying to hide it deflated the whole point of using Khan at all. He didn't have his people, really. He didn't have anything that made him Khan from before, So it was in name only. It certainly wasn't an imagery or anything else that you got from the Montauban version of the character, and the rivalry of between him and Kirk and why they had an established history together. All of that was gone. So if you're saying we're building a new reason for them to have animosity towards each other and have him be the ultimate villain, and maybe even utilize it for more than one film, it could have been a lot better received.
That kind of extends into my view on it, because I'm probably one of the younger podcasters that you've had on this show. I'm 20. So
Jesus,
confession
ouch.
Time. But confession time, I saw these movies reversed to you guys. I saw J.J. Abrams' Into Darkness before I saw Wrath of Khan. So having seen those in that order and not having the context of Wrath of Khan in my head going into it, the entire film, Cumberbatch's Khan, had no context for me. I didn't really understand his motivations. He felt like a hollow character. And then when there's the big Khan yell, I was like, oh, I've seen that before. But I don't have any context to it. So if you had flipped it around and said, here he is, Khan, and given him backstory and given context to what he's happening, and not just made his character a hollow dummy, I think it would have been far more enjoyable. It's perhaps even more so for viewers like me who didn't have the previous films to lend context.
What did you think when you eventually saw Wrath of Khan? What did you think of it?
Oh, I thought it was, in my opinion, I thought it was infinitely better. I loved it, but I liked Abrams's takes enough. I think it was interesting. I had a Twitter conversation a while back with Daryl Skeels, who is the Trek nerd over on the Frog Pants Network. And I asked him what he thought of the J.J. Abrams films, and he thought that they were decent popcorn films, but they weren't what the franchise deserved. And I think what we're hoping for CBS in the coming future is that they do create something that this franchise does deserve. And for me, going into those without much context of Star Trek going back, I had fun with them. But then once I went into Star Trek, it was like it was totally different for me, because these films just felt a little more empty to me, and they didn't feel like they fleshed out the characters in the way I learned about them going back into original Trek.
Yeah, I think there's never really been that deep of a Star Trek movie besides maybe Star Trek the Motion Picture. And I think that's where Star Trek, and I've said this before on this podcast, I think that's where Star Trek excels, is the episodic storytelling.
Yes.
And not the movie storytelling.
Yeah, there's a depth of story to Star Trek that stands out. And I really enjoyed the first of the Abrams Star Trek movies when I saw it the first time. I thought it was a lot of fun. Thought it was a great action movie. Yes, it was light. But I think that was a perfect thing to do to then build off of that and say, now we're going to give you some harder sci-fi. Now we're going to give you some more classic-style Trek with this underlying understanding that we're also going to be updating fight scenes, we're going to be updating action, we're going to be doing those things as well, but it's the sort of like the candy to entice the new viewer in and then say, now that we've got your attention and now that you've got a feel for these characters, we can build upon it. And what they did instead is they sort of took what they did in the first movie and did a lot of it over again in the second movie. The characters didn't really grow. They didn't improve, and the story didn't get deeper and richer. It just became, oh, well, here's these things that were part of classic Trek that you maybe have heard about, and we're just going to put our spin on them. It wasn't even a spin. It was just, like I said, it was name only. And that's unfortunate, because I think it could have been received a lot better if they had gone to the next level instead of staying at the same level. And I'm hoping that the third movie will be a richer, deeper science fiction tale on top of the other things that the movies really do take, with their young stars being able to act these out in a much different way than what the original actors could do in the films.
Well, if the third film disappoints, we've always got the new series to also disappoint. So, so we either got some really great Trek coming up in the next year, or more chances to get disappointed. We'll see, I guess.
Well, at the very least, what it does is it fosters some interest in Trek in a generation that might otherwise not have interest. I hadn't seen a whole lot of the original series. I hadn't seen a lot of TOS or anything like that, or The Next Generation or anything like that. And after I saw Abrams, his first film, that was the catalyst for me to go back and watch the original series and Next Generation and DS9 and all that stuff. And that's kind of what got me hooked on it. So at the very least, it starts a conversation for viewers who might not know about that episodic stuff, who that handles the content better.
It's always interesting to find out how you got hooked to a certain franchise. Like for you, it was the original, the 2009 J.J. Abrams Star Trek.
Yeah.
For somebody else, it might be like a certain Next Generation episode or one of the original films. It's always interesting to find out how it started for you when it comes to either Star Trek or Doctor Who or Star Wars or whatever. Like, I'm going to ask you, Brett, are you a fan of the prequel films for Star Wars?
Okay, so that's a good question with a couple of answers. I grew up with the prequel films, so I have a greater appreciation for them than your generation might have. That said, I love the original trilogy infinitely more. I adore that trilogy, but I do think that the prequel trilogy has its moments. I think it is weak in certain characters and weak in certain development, but I do think it has its moments. Fortunately, I think J.J. Abrams is going in an entirely different direction with 7, but I'm okay with them. In my opinion, I think 3 is one of my favorite films. I love Revenge of the Sith. I'm not a huge fan of 2, and I really don't like 1. But I think they have their moments.
All right, Brad, anything before we move on to the next story?
No, not really.
Okay, all right. So I know that you're a huge Doctor Who fan, Brad. So
that's what I was waiting for.
Yeah. I skipped over this story. Not on purpose, by accident. I'm like, there's only one. I thought there was another. Then I found it. Okay.
Did some creature make you forget?
What?
Check your arm, Dave. See if you got marks in your arm.
Oh, yeah.
Silence is fallen.
I get it. Okay. Silence. Got it. Okay. So Peter Jackson teases a Doctor Who directing gig. This is awesome. In a video posted on his Facebook page, the Lord of the Rings director is seen relaxing at home with his daughter, Katie, while polishing one of his many Oscar statues, which is the best part of the whole video. When Katie alerts her father that Stephen Moffat is trying to get in touch with him, Jackson says that Moffat is always emailing him. However, Jackson tells his daughter that he never answers Moffat's emails because they're unintelligible. The man's got a busy schedule, after all, between Doctor Who and Sherlock. Suddenly, the Doctor himself appears with a contract from the BBC for Jackson to sign. While we don't see Jackson sign the contract, we do see a Dalek threatening to exterminate Peter Capaldi. So we think he's directing an episode?
I think this video is a contract in a way. I mean, why would they put out a video like this if he wasn't?
That's true.
Yeah.
It's definitely going to stir up audience demand.
Absolutely it will.
Yeah. The series has been awesome this season. I mean, it's probably one of the best seasons of Doctor Who that I've ever experienced. But unfortunately, I think the ratings are down a little bit. So
the ratings are down, but when you look at the way people are watching it, at least according to Moffat, they're the same, if not up. Because when your ratings go down, your iPlayer on the BBC goes up.
Yeah.
So,
and I'm sure that
you're right. The actual ratings are down.
Yeah, I'm sure that is similar in the States and North America. I think people are watching it in other ways. Are you guys, I'm sure you guys are excited for this, right? I mean, Peter Jackson, come on. It's,
yeah.
What do you think, what kind of story do you think he's going to direct? What kind of story of Doctor Who do you think he's going to tackle?
I hope it involves puppets.
Okay. Puppets. Nope, you're done.
You don't like Meet the Feebles?
No. It's horrible.
Am I missing something? He did puppets? What are you talking about?
Imagine he did a movie called Meet the Feebles, and basically it's a very adult take on Muppets.
Okay.
You've got Muppets doing heroin. You've got, I mean, it's...
Wow.
It's one of those things, it just shows that some of these great directors that we've come to love, these great storytellers, started out with humble beginnings, we'll say. And Meet the Feebles is a very strange film. Bad Taste is another one that Jackson
did. Oh,
yeah.
Dead
Alive, though, I think is more of a classic.
It is, but going at zombies with a lawnmower is kind of out there.
I could cast for the Lord. I just think it's great to see that they have such great beginnings and their creativity kind of shown through, and they got put in charge of these big things. The same thing when you look at Guardians of the Galaxy with James Gunn, and James Gunn starting out doing trauma films. There's no limit to what these people can do if they are given the right property. But it's kind of fun to see the campy things that they started out with. As far as Peter Jackson, I think it's also interesting that they kind of play off of, well, we're much more interested in going and watching The Walking Dead than Doctor Who right now. I wonder if he's going to get an offer to direct that.
Oh, I forgot about that part in that video. Yeah.
Well, as long as we're talking about other projects that that Peter Jackson may be doing, there was another part of that video that one of you guys may have seen where the Silmarillion was on the table. And there's been some talk about that as well, because he had divided it into little pieces. And I hear the sigh over there. And that's kind of the collective sigh that the entire Tolkien family has about him touching that property, which is why he won't touch it probably. But that's another piece in the video. He's definitely – it was purposely put there.
Yeah, he was trolling.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
I would say that more than Peter Jackson, who I would be excited to see do Doctor Who, would be Guillermo del Toro.
Dude, that would be awesome. I was about to say that I bet you Peter Jackson is going to be more fantasy based episode. But if you put Guillermo del Toro in there, that's another guy that would probably be a more fantasy based episode of Doctor Who, right?
Well, they worked together on the Hobbit films.
Yeah, Del Toro was supposed to do the Hobbit originally, and
right.
Stepped off, and Peter had to come in and take it over. And he even said, much like what Damon Lindelof was talking about earlier, he said that because of the time constraints and everything, it wasn't planned out as well as he would have liked, and that's why the films maybe suffered a little bit. I think Jackson's a great storyteller. I did not enjoy the Hobbit movies in comparison to how great The Lord of the Rings was, but I can see that it was a huge task to undertake and maybe wasn't planned out as well as it should have been. So I don't think that he necessarily couldn't do more in the Tolkien realm. I just think that they have to be a little more careful next time.
I
don't know what he could do. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, is there a certain like character or storyline from the Doctor Who, from the franchise of Doctor Who that they've touched on before? Do you think that he would be good at like retelling or continuing the story of?
Capaldi's Weeping Angels. He hasn't touched them yet.
That's right.
And Smith had his take, and Tennant had his original one, and especially if you had someone like Del Toro in that, that'd be really cool.
Yep.
I think he'd do a great job with that.
Absolutely. Del Toro, I think creating new creatures would be fantastic. Jackson, I would like to see a giant war between multiple factions. I think that if he had that kind of budget, because his army scenes from the Lord films are incredible, how he can make a battle scene run and you can keep up with it both visually and still build story at the same time. If they could do something like that with Doctor Who, with some of the different races, that could be amazing.
All right, we'll have to revisit this when the time comes of his episode and see if we were right or not. That's a fun game to play. All right, let's do our final news story of the week. And I don't know how familiar you guys are with this person or this series, but Al Markham, actor on the TV serial Tom Corbett, Space Cadet, dies at the age of 88 years old. The man who portrayed Astro, a young engineer from Venus, on the popular show died last week, his family announced. Now, Brad, I know that you're really into like 1950s sci-fi, so have you watched episodes of Tom Corbett before?
Actually, no, I have not.
Okay. Well,
yeah, I went and I watched some shorts that were available on YouTube, and it seems very familiar, but I don't know how much of it was familiarity or how much of it was similarities to other things that were in the sci-fi genre from the same era, that a lot of them looked and had very similar characters. I can see how it would have been popular at its time. It's amazing how popular it was for the fact that it played on multiple networks.
Yeah, it went from CBS, ABC, NBC to the Dumont Network, Yeah, there was a network called the Dumont Network at one time, and then it back to NBC again. And it's very much a children's type program. I don't think they really did too much heavy topics. I think it's very fun. Like, kids like, don't you agree, Corey?
Absolutely. It has that kind of Flash Gordon feel to it. In modern take would probably be something what Calvin would have modeled it after it to make Spaceman Spiff.
Mm-hmm. So 1950 to 55 was the broadcast era for this show, and it was broadcast live from a New York studio. That's what they did back then. It was set in the 24th century and featured the adventures of Astro and others from the Space Academy who travel around the solar system on the ship Polaris. They began as 15-minute installments and had the rare distinction... Oh, we talked about that already. So 15-minute shows, which was also something that you don't see these days. Markham later worked at MGM and served as executive in charge of production on a couple of films. And then he went on to co-found a video duplication firm called Teletronics and entered into a partnership with Sony. The company would later become Video Corp of America and merge with Technicolor. He was inducted into the Video Hall of Fame in 1996. So he had a interesting career trajectory after getting out of doing actually starring in TV, going from that to executive producer to something entirely different in video duplication. It's sounds like he had a very interesting life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
88 years old. It's a nice age to live to. That's for sure. My dad is 93 this year, and my mom is 83. So they're both in that age range right there. All right. Anything? Any comments before we move on to the big question, guys?
Not necessarily, but I do think that Tom Cole Corbett show is worth doing a YouTube search on, because I spent about an hour this morning rifling through some of the videos, and they're a kick to watch. Yeah. It's so kitschy, and even if you compare it between the 10 or 13 year gap until TOS, it's so just 50s in every way that yep. I thought it was adorable to watch. I got a kick out of it.
Yeah,
so.
It's fun, and it's you have to watch it with a certain perspective, and you can't mm-hmm. take it too seriously. But then at the same time, I think you can take a look at that series as setting the tone for other shows and other movies that came after it, and was probably the inspiration for a lot of other science fiction going all the way up until today's era, right? I mean, that had to be...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like when I... To take this into a musical... analogy, if I will, it's just comparing Grandmaster Flash or something even before that to a modern artist like Kanye West or Kendrick Lamar or whatever, and that's something I do a lot on the jukebox, because we have to look at the lineage at which something we love, how did it just come to be, because it didn't just pop out of nowhere, and this is definitely something somewhere along the way that meant something to someone and came afterward, and it's fun to take a look at. It was pretty well done in terms of 1950 through 1955. It's a kick to watch.
You can probably look at a show like Mystery Science Theater 3000 that has a lot of the same characteristics as this show. MST3K obviously is a spoof of things, but it has a lot of the same elements as a show like this.
And it also creates things, you know, trying to use materials on the cheap, where it's not got a huge budget to make the show week to week, and it's just trying to make that set look and feel interesting and keep things working. And that owes a lot to these types of shows, which at that point in time, it wasn't like Hollywood wouldn't build a big set, but TV didn't have that kind of budget or ability.
No. Yeah, that's for sure. All right, so we would love your feedback on any of the stories that we talked about tonight. Like, for example, do you think it was a bad idea for the producers and director of Star Trek Into Darkness to hide the fact that Cumberbatch was Khan, or what do you think of Peter Jackson directing an episode of Doctor Who? What kind of story would you like to see him tackle? Or Neil deGrasse Tyson, do you agree with his assessment of the Enterprise over the Millennium Falcon? Let us know by emailing galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. That's galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. Or call our voicemail number, and that's 805-328-3966. 805-328-3966. Okay, let's move on to the big question of the week, and it is a hypothetical question. I love asking these kind of questions because it opens up the conversation to a lot of different aspects of it. So this kind of has a Star Trek feel to it. So you're the captain of a starship, and one of three things happen. A, you get a distress call from an uncharted planet along your course. B, an enemy ship violates a nearby neutral zone. Or C, sensors detect a time-space anomaly. Which one of these would you rather investigate and why? If you had a choice between one of these three things, you could pick one, what would that one thing be and why? Who wants to go first?
I would probably go with C, the time-space anomaly. More for protecting other people. A distress call means that there's danger. Enemy ship violating a neutral zone also means that there's a chance at war. Time-space anomaly could be interesting, and judging by the first couple of seasons of Voyager, they kept just showing them having time-space problems and then nothing ever happening by the end, so it seems like it would be completely uneventful.
So, and I was thinking that maybe, you know, if you entered this anomaly or this whatever it is, that when you get back, those two things may not be happening still. You know, if you're like, you may change the future or the present by going through that time-space anomaly, right?
Yeah.
I mean, look at the, what was the episode of Next Generation? When the Enterprise C came through, right?
And that was a great episode.
Yep.
What was that called? What was that one called? Or Yesterday's Enterprise, right? I think so. Yeah.
Sounds right.
So before the Enterprise C came through, or as it was coming through, that changed because they didn't help the Klingons in their fight against the Romulans. So the Federation ended up being at war, and Tasha Yar was still alive. So
yeah.
They sent the ship.
Alive and then had a descendant later.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I mean, that's the thing about Star Trek, man. The storylines, the way that they layer with the continuation of them, where they either just build on it because it's there, or they think ahead of what can we do with this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something that the movies just are really going to have to struggle to match.
Throwback to our previous discussion. Brett, which one are you going to pick?
I had some trouble with this today, and I probably spent way more time with it than I should have. So all three of these are potential hazardous situations. Excuse me. All these are potentially hazardous, right? You could get a distress call, and maybe they're luring you there. You could get an enemy ship in a nearby neutral zone, and that is obviously going to stir up some sort of conflict. And then my big problem with C was, say I go for this temporal anomaly, and then I get sucked in. Now it's 1949 and I'm up the creek. So that was something I didn't want to deal with. So I kind of went with the distress call because it's uncharted, first of all. It's an uncharted planet, and that in itself is kind of cool. So maybe there's something we can find there. I thought of this. I don't think as much in Star Trek terms as I do in Stargate terms. That is the show that I grew up with and I just absolutely adore. And I remember a great episode of SGU, which was the newer one, where they found a distress call, and there ended up not being anyone there, but what they ended up finding was a giant, giant library of information about the people that were there prior to them, and it tied into the quest that they were on. So I think the distress call is a couple different avenues that could potentially be really cool, and you're helping people, and that's good too. So that's probably where I would go. The least interesting to me is the enemy ship violating the neutral zone. I don't want to deal with enemy ship. I want to go help people with a distress signal. Let someone else deal with that or get sucked into a time-space anomaly.
Brett, what did you, speaking of SGU, what did you think of Stargate Universe in the grand scheme of Stargate shows?
So when it came out, I really, really did not like it because it changed the formula of Stargate entirely. It just completely defied everything Stargate was supposed to be because Stargate the good and the bad of Stargate was that it was formulaic in a way. SGU set a formula, and that's something that Atlantis continued, and they had variations on that, and they were both very successful with that to different extents, I think. When you look at SGU, they completely defied that formula. They made it more drama-oriented. They made it a bit more character-oriented. It was almost a little Melrose Place, like a little bit got like Gossip Girl type drama that got infused into it, and I think that turned a lot of people off. And the other thing was that the Stargate was kind of backseat to the entire thing. They only used the Stargate like a dozen times in the entire two seasons or whatever. But going back to it about a year ago and watching the two seasons again, I think it's a fine show. I think they tried the change of formula, and that was met with a lot of distrust and a lot of disdain from an audience that was really comfortable with that formula. And I think it would have been really, really cool to see where they went with it because it got really good in the second season, I thought. So I think it gets unjustly attacked. I don't think it's as great as it could have been, but I think it was a step forward in the right direction for Stargate. And if it had stuck around, we may still have Stargate now. And now we just have a void of that franchise, even though Roland Emmerich wants to bring it back, and that was hinted at about a year ago when he said he wanted to make a new trilogy and just throw out all of the stuff that's happened in the past 20 years because he doesn't really like that stuff. But I thought it was a good show.
They tried to make Stargate Universe more like Battlestar Galactica, which was the hot show at the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
The two don't really mesh too much, and I could see why those fans, there was an outcry against that show because the fans were so used to that certain, it's like making a Star Trek series more like
Gotham.
Well, that's sure. an extreme example, but yeah, I could see that.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of the problems that people had was that the whole idea of Stargate Universe is that they can't use the Stargate. That is kind of the shtick of the entire two seasons. So they kind of replaced that massive aspect of it because the fun of the previous two shows was every episode you'd go out, you'd have a different adventure, you'd meet different people, different life forms, different planets, different conflicts, races, all that stuff, and that's what made Stargate really appealing. They kind of removed that when they said, here's 100 people stuck on a ship, and they're always going to be stuck on the ship for the next two seasons. That said, they did replace that element in some capacity when they said, but now they're always on a straight linear line that they cannot change. They cannot alter their course, at least until... it's been over 2 weeks. There can be spoilers. Until they figure out how to later. But my point is that when they're on that course, and the entire crew perceives that they're on that course, they come up and they find all those things just naturally because they're going past them and they have no choice but to interact with them or die. So in some ways, they took that concept of exploration and finding new things and almost made it dramatically more extreme. So I think it got a bad racket.
Also, I mean, you've got to look at the fact that with Star Trek, when they did Next Gen and then they spun off and they did Deep Space Nine and then they did Voyager, you still had the first shows going at the same time, so it made sense to not do the same show over again, just in a different location, but to change what it was about. With what it sounds like with Stargate is that you had the show that was coming back to kind of build off of what had happened before, but you didn't have that other style of show anymore. So if the original Stargate is gone and Stargate Atlantis is gone when they're bringing out this new series, people are wanting to watch Stargate because it was Stargate, and you're not giving them that, you're giving them something else. If it had existed side by side, then it would have been, okay, these are different things explored in this universe, so we're getting a different style of show, but I've got the original Stargate over here, and I've got this new thing over here, and that could be received differently that way.
And you could even look at that in comparison, like Atlantis had some modest success going for five seasons, and that for two or three of those seasons, I can't remember which, that was going side by side SG1 until SG1 closed out. And that was really cool to actually have them back and forth, because that created a bunch of story dynamics between the two that won't be lost on you entirely if you hadn't seen the other show. But for people who had, it had a whole new dynamic. And what you're kind of alluding at is that it gave you the best of both worlds, and you got to choose what you liked and what you could follow. Whereas with SGU came about, all the other two were dead. You had had, what, 15 years? 15 years altogether, if you combine all the seasons, of a established formula that you like, and now all of a sudden we're just dropping you in this entirely new realm of the way we're going to make a show that you have liked for over a decade. It just, they went in a drastic direction too soon, and they should have eased it into it.
Brad?
I really only watched Stargate SG-1 for the first season. After that,
okay,
I really kind of lost interest. So,
how about your answer on this? On this, the three scenarios you got the distress call, you got the ship entering the neutral zone, or you got the time space anomaly thingy going on. Which one do you choose?
You know, I had plenty of time to think about it, and I think I agree with Brett. I would answer the distress call. Ultimately, if you're, to me, the way I've always envisioned what Starfleet was all about, it was about helping, and, well, yeah, it was about exploration too, but we've all seen too many Star Trek shows to know what happens when you investigate a time-space anomaly. You're going to get sucked into it or screwed somehow. And I don't, nobody's got time for that.
Well, you do if you're in a time-space anomaly.
You got all the time in the universe. And an enemy ship violates the neutral zone. I agree with Brett. I don't care.
Refugees in.
Let somebody else deal with that.
I just thought of another example of the time-space anomaly was the time loop episode from the Next Generation, when they kept on blowing up the ship, or the ship kept on blowing up, and they had to...
The perspective episode.
Yeah, yep. With Kelsey Grammer as the captain of the ship that they kept on running into at the end.
Yeah, and you could even tie that in, as long as we're on the train of thought of Stargate. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was thinking about the episode where it was... everybody was trying to depend on Troy to figure out who was lying, and that was the "You're a dead man, Abgar." That was the scientist who was very certain that Riker was screwing his wife, and he ends up activating his machine, and stuff gets blown up.
Yeah,
the scientist gets killed.
The whole audience knew that wasn't that Riker was innocent, just because of the way they portrayed him in the portrayal of that he was supposed to be this other person. Yeah, that was a good episode.
Yeah, I was confusing that episode, because at the end of each one, it was everything blew up. The distress call is definitely where I would go, and that's kind of the person I am anyway. You know, I'd want to help. I'd want to be able to go and take care of a situation and be support. That's just kind of how I roll anyway. So
let's take this one step further. What kind of planet do you guys want to go to? Like, if it's, or what situation would you want it to be in order,
you know, I always hope it's going to be Riker's pleasure planet. Like, if you want to go with classic Kirk, you go to the uncharted planet, because there's probably somebody there to bang.
Talos 4.
Which one was Talos 4? Was that... Oh, that was the... No. Was that the cage planet?
Yes.
Okay. The big-headed dudes?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. All right. Thanks, guys.
I don't think I could pick a... go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead, Brett.
Oh, I was just going to say, I don't think I could do a Star Trek planet, because I don't know enough of them, so I'll just go to Endor. That way I can play with the Ewoks.
Right on.
All right.
Now I'll go through this time-space anomaly so I get the original Ewok music. Thank you. You have no...
Yes. Yep.
Wait a second. They changed the Ewok music?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Anything you love, they change.
Grumble, 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 grumble. All right, cool. So it's up to you, dear listener. What is your scenario that you want to tackle? Let us know by emailing galacticnetcasts@gmail.com or call ye old voicemail, 805-328-3966, 805-328-3966. All right.
It's so interesting to hear somebody else do the readings for that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, because on the Podcast of Terror, Corey usually tackles it, and it's like pulling off a Band-Aid on Podcast of Terror. It's like, and contact and then subscribe in the Galactic Collective. That's my interpretation.
I think I've gotten a little succinct with it.
No, you do
it. Trying to choose right at the right time to tackle it, though. Like, what line can I use to transition into this?
No, you do a great job. I'm just joking. I'm just pulling your chain, yanking your chain, Corey.
Ooh, sexy.
Yeah, this is not the Podcast of Terror. No dirty talk, no sexual innuendo. This is clean family fun.
I don't think you understand what sci-fi geeks want then, sir.
Yeah, I probably don't. I'm too removed from... Yeah. All right. So let's tackle our recommendations. These are things that we have, experienced, watched, listened to, played, whatever, as far as sci-fi themed things. And on our document here, looks like Corey is at the top of the list. Corey, what do you got for your recommendation?
I did something this week that I haven't done in a long time, which is I actually read some of the comics that I've been buying. Oh, wow. Such an expensive hobby to just leave stacking up in a corner. And I had been seeing some raves about this new series by Brian K. Vaughan and Cliff Chiang called Paper Girls from Image Comics. And it is about four girls who deliver the newspaper in their neighborhood in 1988. You have to kind of discover when the time is going on through the series. I don't think there's anything specifically that tells you about where they are or anything at first, but there is a election poster on somebody's lawn for Bush running in 1988. And so it starts out pretty casual with one of the girls getting up in the morning, going to deliver papers. She runs into some kind of jerkish guys. It's the night of Halloween, so it's November 1st morning, early morning when she's out there, and she meets up with some other paper girls who kind of team up with her and protect her, and they're a little bit more established in the neighborhood. It goes from what seems like a pretty simple story of this to involving aliens, time travel, a whole bunch of weird stuff just starts happening and popping off. And I don't want to give too much away about it, but it's incredibly well done. And Brian Vaughan does Saga for Image Comics, which has been a phenomenal series since the beginning. And it's done some great work before that at other companies. He did Ex Machina over at DC.
Oh, yes.
His Swamp Thing run was actually pretty good, too. So he's a great creator. Cliff Chiang has done fantastic work, and this is a beautiful book. But it's on the third issue, just came out this week. So it's pretty early into the series. I don't know if it's an ongoing or if it's a miniseries, but it's really good. And I'm vested in the characters. These four, I think they're around 12 or 13 years of age, girls riding on their bikes, delivering papers, and being stuck in a world where everything just starts to go crazy. It has a sci-fi slant, but it's always about characterization with Vaughn's stuff.
No, it's got a bunch of different sci-fi elements. If you're talking aliens and time travel, come on. That's the hallmarks of sci-fi right there.
Yeah, and I mean, there's... I don't want to say too much about it, but there's a lot more even than that going on into it.
Okay, all right. I think you're sold me, my friend. I'm probably going to stop over at the comic book shop right across the street from my new job and pick that up this weekend.
Little plug. Your new job where you play music that would be appropriate to the era of what this comic takes place.
Yeah, I do a show called Total 80s Live on our local classic hit station here in Ottawa. And you can listen to it online if you want. Friday nights at Boom boom997.com. boom997.com. All right. That's my only plug for myself this episode. Thank you. I'm going to kind of segue from talking comics with you, Corey, and talking a comic book YouTube channel called Variant Comics. Are you guys familiar with Variant Comics YouTube channel? Any of you guys?
Variant? No.
It's really cool. The guy started off at what was the web content company that did a bunch of like tech shows and some gaming shows as well. They were heavy on the video, and I forget the name of the website. Anyways, that doesn't matter. Variant Comics is a YouTube channel, and he specializes...
Revision 3?
Yeah, Revision 3. Thank you. God damn it. All right. So he specializes in talking about the history of, like, for example, Batman. The history of Batman. Or the history of Jessica Jones. Like, he does timely things where he just, like, the Jessica Jones show recently premiered on Netflix. So he did an episode of one of his videos was the history of Jessica Jones. But he'll also do, like, top five darkest moments in comics, for example. Or his most recent video is the history of Star Wars, because Star Wars Episode 7 is coming out. And there's a lot of Star Wars content right now, including the Star Wars comic books, which he also touches on. And he's going to do a number of Star Wars videos up until the release of Episode 7. So if you want, like, short, probably the longest he does is maybe, I think I saw a 15-minute video one time from him, but they're mainly around 8 minutes long. And if you want to, if you're like me and don't know that much about comic books, although I'm learning all the time, these are great videos to watch because he really breaks down the history of certain characters and certain storylines and certain genres of comic books and sci-fi geekiness. So check it out, Variant Comics on YouTube. I think you'll enjoy it. He's got a great personality, the host.
I'm familiar with it now that I've seen it and seen the logo. I remember it. It's been a while, but I think it was because Revision 3 went away, and so there was probably a period between them kind of disappearing and him taking it over on his own.
Yeah. No, he does a great job. I'm constantly impressed. I love going to YouTube. Like, I got like 5-10 minutes to cover with something. I'll just go to YouTube and either watch one of the Variant Comics videos or Emergency Awesome is my other go-to video, my YouTube channel. All right, Brad, you're next on recommendations. What do you got?
I think it was March we talked about a trailer for a short film that was going to come out called The Shaman. And it was a future of Earth where shamans, basically, not necessarily medicine men, but they were mages of a sort. And this war that goes on for like 70 years on Earth is really kind of centered around these powerful mages, these shamans. And it's a 17-minute short film, and it has the feel of like a 2-hour epic film. I mean, they went all out with how they filmed it, with the effects, everything. And it's just absolutely beautiful. And it's not even so much that it's just good to look at, but the tight storytelling that they have to do to do this segment and to do it right in 17 minutes is spectacular. I have the link from the IO9 story. You can finally watch one of this year's best short films called The Shaman. And they are not kidding. It's well worth the watch.
Yeah, if IO9 recommends something, you should watch it or you should read it. Because IO9 has very good taste when it comes to sci-fi and geeky stuff.
Absolutely, they do.
Cool.
So
17.
Yeah, I watched it during my lunch today. So
you said it was 17 minutes long?
17 minutes.
I think we can all handle that, right?
I think so. It's well acted. Like I said, it's well acted. The set design, the costumes, everything looks like a war-torn future that it has interesting bits of style that you'll have to watch and just kind of look at the separate pieces and the battle that this particular shaman has to take to kind of save a portion of mankind and what it costs him is truly spectacular. So 17 minutes of intrigue and sci-fi that you will not regret watching.
Yeah, just the stills from it are gorgeous. Yeah. And I spent half of my day watching Nick Offerman drink scotch in front of her.
Yes. That's right.
On a 45-minute video that I replayed like 3 times. So I can spare 17 minutes to watch some cool sci-fi stuff.
Was he like, would he make noise once in a while, or would he look up?
He'd like grunt a little bit and then refill his glass, and he's always staring you down too,
contentedly drinking the scotch, slowly enjoying it, and savoring every precious moment. It is a thing of beauty. It is going to play on my TV the entire time of Christmas week, I think.
I was
going to
say, you know, you have a house party of some kind, you just put that on the TV and it's like an added guest, right?
It's an added attraction because it's Nick Offerman.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a badass. He's killing it on Fargo this season.
All right. Thanks, Brad. Let's round out the recommendations with Brett. What do you got, Brett?
Okay, so my recommendation isn't necessarily science fiction, so I'll give a quick little science fiction recommendation as well. But if you haven't had a chance to check it out, it does dabble in science fiction, and it does kind of toy with some science fiction elements. The Leftovers, which we talked about very briefly earlier in the show, because Lindelof is the director, and it's on HBO, and it is, in my opinion, the finest show they've done in years. Obviously, they have some great stuff going on right now, Game of Thrones, obviously, and so much other fantastic content. But the way The Leftovers has handled itself the past two seasons is it's an intriguing thing that delves into each character in an extreme way, where it's a character piece, and it's all about humanity. Because this tragedy happens, and you are introduced to all these characters. And the way they cope with that tragedy is so dramatically different from one another. And the society that grows out of it, and the culture that grows out of that worldwide tragedy, is absolutely compelling. And this season in particular, the first season, 3% of the population of the world just disappears. They just go away. And the second season right now, they're delving into some other more science fiction and perhaps I guess religious, but I don't think they're trying to get religious, but like purgatory and having characters randomly disappear again, and people are afraid this is going to start happening again, and people coming back from the dead and all sorts of crazy stuff. And it's so well acted. The actors are superb and the story is so well written, and it's very, very, very much worth your time if you have HBO. I would argue it's even worth getting HBO over. For a little more direct science fiction recommendation, if you haven't checked out the other Alpha Geek Radio podcasters, Tom Merritt's new book, I just got a chance to read it because he kept promoting it on his own shows, and it's very good. It's called Citadel 32. It's a worthwhile science fiction read if that's what you're looking for.
Was that book out when we had Tom on the show, Brad? I don't remember.
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a great book. It's not perfect, but it is a really, really, really good book that he does a lot with very little space, and it's very much worth reading. And if you're an average reader, you'll get through it in a couple days. It's not too long, but it's a good read.
Was that a NaNoWriMo book?
A what book?
Was that a
NaNoWriMo? I think it is one of the ones that he did during NaNoWriMo.
Same.
Oh, okay.
That's okay. So usually he takes November. NaNoWriMo is, you write a 50,000-word book in a matter of 30 days during the month of November. It's been every year for the last, I think, 15 years or so they've been doing it. I just failed spectacularly at it again.
How close were you?
Oh, this month, not close at all. It was not my worst effort, but it was definitely down there. I don't want to excuse anything about it. It was completely my choice, but I know that November is a terrible time to try to do NaNo. I've done it in April. They do Camp NaNoWriMo in April and June, and that might be a better time for me.
My wife found a neat article online of other month themes, like I forget what they were, but other ways of doing NaNoWriMo without doing NaNoWriMo. It was
there's one of them in the creations. There's one of them in the music community that I will be doing this year, which is FAWM, February Album Writing Month, and the competition is to do either a song a day or I think a 30-minute album, something like that. But it just stretches you out. I don't think these ideas are necessarily meant to produce something that you could sell or you could turn into something that's competitive product, even though Tom has definitely done that because it's a nice little book. But it's an idea of stretching your chops and your craft. And whether you're a writer, it's clearly the pole of that is writing 50,000 words, because that in itself is a massive endeavor. And if you're a musician, actually sitting down and saying, I'm going to write something and then I'm ultimately going to record it, because what that specific one, you write something, you record something, you put it out, and you put it all together on a record. And that is just as probably, I would argue, just as much work as writing a short novel. So there's lots of ways to do that, and they may not necessarily be designed to create marketable content, but they, I would argue, almost better. Even if you fail spectacularly at them, you haven't. Because the fact that you even tried and the fact that you sat down and wrote as much as you did, regardless of how much that was, you wouldn't have done it otherwise.
And it makes you better at your craft, whatever that craft is.
Exactly.
And it also teaches you to do something every day. It's trying to get into practice. It's like doing push-ups the first day. You're going to have a terrible time, and you may set a goal for the month of how many push-ups you want to do, and you might not reach that. But if you get up every day and you do a few, you know, you're eventually going to build more strength, and it's going to become a habit. I've done sprint things. We did a 24-hour comic day once where you try to do a 24-page comic in 24-hour period of writing, drawing, everything. There's script versions of NaNoWriMo. But even if you go off of something like Jonathan Colton started out doing his musical work, doing a thing a week. That was his first four albums. Were those projects where every week he was doing a new song from beginning to finish and built an entire career and is super fandom out of it.
Yep.
So it's just the idea of, it's not so much I'm going to do 50,000 words in 30 days, but it's that I'm going to write every day, or I'm going to write so much every week that you try to make a lifelong thing, not just a every November thing. But there are people who do it just in November and have mild to fantastic success. I know Jim C. Hines just started doing his novel in November, and he's a professional writer normally, but it was just kind of like, at the same time that I'm doing this, I can also try to win NaNoWriMo, and it'll maybe push me a little bit harder than what I normally do.
All right. I wasn't planning on discussing this, and I don't know if you guys caught them this week, but did anybody watch the Flash and Arrow crossover episodes?
Not yet.
Okay. Not yet.
Okay. All right. Never mind.
I haven't
then.
Seen an episode of Flash, and I've only seen Arrow through its second season, so that's something I really need to get on.
Brett.
Because I loved Arrow in the second season.
It gets so good. Like, they're totally, like, they're embracing the superhero genre. Like, you know, yeah. Arrow started out as being kind of a dark CW-ish kind of relationship, sort of in the guise of a superhero. But it's definitely full-on superhero now. So
that's cool. Flash, I like that.
Flash is a superhero show from the very beginning, and I think that it's helped pull in Arrow to being more of that type of show, finding that there's an acceptance to it. Because there's always been kind of a dance around whether or not people accept one of these shows with superheroes in it. And obviously the films have done very well, but when we had Smallville, they didn't want to put Superman in the show. They wanted it to be Clark Kent. They didn't want him to fly. They didn't want him to have the cape, but they wanted to have all those other elements. And Flash was in a long time, the first one of these shows that was purely, this is a comic book superhero show, live action, done incredibly well, and has so much fun with it, and is, you know, every kind of in joke and Easter egg that you could hope for and imagine from a comic fan perspective, but a fun show for people who aren't comic fans yet, who are just learning, like Dave, who doesn't have a lot of comic book history knowledge, but is picking up so much of it by watching this program week after week. My, I cannot give it enough compliments.
And my wife, who is totally not a comic book person, loves the show. But she, yeah. But she does. She sometimes, when it gets too over the top, she's like, "Yeah, that's pushing it right there."
Well, I think the first season of Arrow at least did it justice in some, to some extent with that, because for me, seeing the first season of Arrow, I know a lot of people have said it's a little too CW, it's a little too romancey and all that stuff, and that's all very, very true, and I felt that when watching it. But it did give me context to the character, and it helped build his backstory and why he is what he is, and I think they did a really good job of that, especially in the flashbacks. I think are pretty cool. So I just need to get up to date on it, and I really need to get on that, especially because Flash is now... The next season of Arrow and Flash, I believe, are both on Netflix now.
Yeah. So you have no excuse now, Brett. Start watching.
No, I need to drop everything and do it. But I need to do it with Jessica Jones, too, and I haven't seen that. I did see Daredevil, though.
Yeah, Jessica Jones. I'm getting in about two episodes a week. I'm slower. I'm not the... I got a lot... You know, it's amazing. I used to have so much time on my hands, not so much anymore. And I don't even have a full-time job yet. Imagine when that happens. Oh my God.
But you are a full-time creator, Dave.
Yeah. And I'm a husband now and a father, so there's a lot of components going on.
Wasn't that the beauty of them putting out the entire season at once? Is essentially you choosing your schedule on that and not waiting every night.
Yep.
Every one night of the week. So.
Yep. It's perfect.
But it's tough too, because especially with a show like Jessica Jones, where everybody was talking about it the first weekend that it came out, and all these articles were being published about, do you know about Jessica Jones? Have you watched the show? And talking about David Tennant's character and Luke Cage and all of these great things that were part of it, that even I had watched the first six episodes in the first weekend, and I was like, okay, now I can take a break and get to the next episodes the next weekend. But by that next weekend, I felt like I was missing out on so many great conversations that were happening about the show because everybody else had just mainlined it and gotten all through it. And I'm like, no, I'm still seven episodes behind you. This sucks.
Well, Corey,
that is true. When you have a weekly show, you have a discussion throughout each week.
Yeah.
Right.
And the great thing, Corey, is that those discussions will live on the internet. They're still there. You just have to find them.
Yeah, but discussing things with people on the internet is sometimes frightening and terrible.
Yeah.
Well, I actually haven't even seen, this came out this month as well, I believe, The Man in the High Castle. I saw the pilot for it when they dropped that last year, but that's another one on my list I got to check out.
All right. Hey, that's it for a show. Thank you, everybody. It was awesome. A couple of things before we actually officially get out of here. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the Sci-Fi Geeks Club on our website, which is gncasts.com. gncasts.com. Click on the subscribe tab and there'll be a drop down thing. You click on the Sci-Fi Geeks Club and all the proper links will be there, including iTunes, Stitcher. You can subscribe to the RSS. You can get an email subscription. We give you plenty of options. Or just go to iTunes, and while you're there, give us a 5-star if you like us, or a review while you're subscribing. Or at Stitcher, give us a thumbs up there. You can subscribe to our other shows, including the podcast that Corey is part of, which is called The Podcast of Terror with Matt Stein, all about horror movies and horror topics and a lot of swearing.
A lot of swearing.
Yeah.
We will not let you down in that regard.
Yeah.
But we've had some great guests, too.
Yeah. You've had some awesome guests recently. And we're going to work on a crossover episode between Podcast of Terror and Weird World Weekly. And I don't know if Matt discussed this with you, Corey, or not. But
I just show up, man.
Okay. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to take a movie inspired by a real event. You guys will talk about the movie, and then we'll talk about the real event on Weird World Weekly. How's that sound?
Oh, I love it. I absolutely love it. Weird World Weekly is, even if I didn't know you guys, it's a show that I love so much. I just really enjoy that program. So
thanks,
having
man.
Some sort of ties to that would be fantastic. Other than the fact that I've done an episode, you know, no big deal.
Yeah, Weird World Weekly, even I, as the host of the show, have trouble saying it. That's also available on gncasts.com. So is Adventure Party, Brad's podcast, which is being cranked out week in and week out. What else? Yep. What else? Oh, Alien Invasion is another one. That's our longest running podcast. And we've got the shorties. We got Who Knew in Review, and we've got Galactic Gaming News. And
so what Dave is suggesting is that instead of just going over to gncast.com and signing up and listening to the Sci-Fi Geeks Club, why don't you download our mega feed, which includes all of our great programs?
That's a great idea, Corey.
That's true.
That's easy. Easy peasy. That's the easiest solution whatsoever.
One-stop shop.
All right. Also, one more time, thank you to Alpha Geek Radio for hosting the live stream every Thursday night at 9:45 Eastern Time. We're on Channel 2. So thank you, Todd Whitehead, and the gang at Alpha Geek Radio at alphageekradio.com or tunein.alphageekradio.com. Brett, thank you for being our guest this week on the Sci-Fi Geeks Club. Where can people find you and your stuff online?
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been wonderful. You can find me on brettstewart.net. That is BRETTSTEWART.net. There you can find the Jukebox podcast. You can find all of the music I've been putting out. I just put out a new record in this past year, and if you want to check that out, it'll be on that website under the moniker of Rivers Rubin, which is actually how you can find me on Twitter, too, at Rivers Rubin. That is R-I-V-E-R-S. Rubin with an I, not an E, R-U-B-I-N.
Awesome. All right. You have been listening to a production of Galactic Netcasts. I'm Dave Nelson on behalf of Brad, Corey, Matt.
Bye, Dave.
Who else is here? Anessa, Gregor, JF, and Brett. We'll talk to you guys next time.
Bye. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for another meeting of the Sci-Fi Geeks Club. Did you know you could help support this network financially for as little as $1 a month? Come on, that's less than a cup of coffee. Support this network now at patreon.com/galacticnetcasts. If you liked what you heard, then make sure to subscribe for free on iTunes, Stitcher, or by going to gncasts.com/subscribe. And if you really enjoyed the podcast, leave us a 5-star rating and review. Even better, tell your friends and family about the Sci-Fi Geeks Club from Galactic Netcasts.
You have been listening to a production of Galactic Netcasts. For more about the show you just listened to, including how to subscribe and give us feedback, plus additional podcasts from the Galactic Network, daily news features, videos, links to our social networks, and more, go to gncasts.com. That's gncasts.com.